Welcome to the Let's Clear the Air Energy Podcast. Conversations focused on how some of the world's top energy leaders are innovating to deliver clean, affordable, and reliable energy for the future.
Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of the Let's Clear the Air Energy Podcast. Today we're joined by a great guest. Tucker Perkins is an energy expert with 4 decades of experience in liquid and renewable fuels area. Since 2017, he's served as president and CEO of the Propane Education and Research Council, PERC, if you've heard that acronym before. And if you've ever heard him speak, you probably know a few things. His favorite topic is the future. And he embraces a bunch of pragmatic solutions for reducing greenhouse gas emissions while also providing affordable, reliable energy that we need. Tucker authored The Path to Zero book, which you can get from Simon & Schuster or any major bookseller. He hosts the Path to Zero podcast, where he discusses energy, climate change, with thought leaders and experts with a broad swath of industries and fields, everything from internal combustion engines to nuclear fusion, electrification, and environmental justice. So sounds like that's right up our alley. Tucker, we're thrilled to have you today. Thanks for joining.
Well, we're so happy to be with you today. Thanks. Thanks to you and the rest of the crew there.
So we didn't discuss this beforehand, but we kind of like to dive in on a let's clear the air question so that the audience can get to know you a little bit better. I'm trying to think of kind of, we're in fall, it's sports season right now. So let's clear the air. Are you a sports guy, one? And two, if so, what are you getting into right now? Football, hockey starting, I think. Basketball starting, I think. Pro, college. You tell us.
In the fall, you have to be a football guy, right? You have to be. And I live kind of sandwiched between a bunch of pro teams. I live south of the Commanders now and the Ravens, which I kind of pull for. But for us, it's all about ACC football, really. It's not even about SEC football. Although this is a year most of us in the ACC are just kind of watching and thinking and hoping for 3 years out. Not much excitement in the ACC right now.
Yep. Well, good. It's definitely football season here in Texas. I'm sure we just had the Red River rivalry here in Dallas, so I'm kind of happy that traffic's gone, to be honest.
I watched a part of that. That was fun.
Well, let's dig in a little bit. You know, a recent analysis from the Department of Energy found that without significant changes, we're, you know, as a country, at pretty big risk for upcoming blackouts and power outages and things like that by, I think the study said 2030, but you know, what did you pull from that analysis, and what are your kind of thoughts on how we can start preparing now?
Yeah, the punchline out of that study, which was alarming even to me, was that anybody in the United States could expect their interruptions of electricity to increase 100% between now and 2030. And if you read the fine print to that prediction, it didn't even take into account weather-related events. That was just from strain on the grid. And, you know, it's always alarming. I spend a lot of time looking at EIA data and IEA data and DOE data, but it's really alarming when the people in charge of things like FERC or DOE, you know, start raising an alarm flag. And I think that's something that most of us knew, but even, you know, for us that is so deep into the energy mix, because as you really point out, I love to think about the propane molecule more than any other molecule, but it's really irrelevant in a vacuum, right? You have to think about, what is the future of nuclear, both fission and fusion? What was or is the future of hydrogen? How does natural gas play? What are their renewable twins, renewable nat gas and renewable propane? How is that going to impact things? But it's shocking when you begin to really realize how fragile the grid is. And something that we've talked about, I talked about in my book, you know, one of my favorite interviewers was Meredith Angwin. Meredith is just delightful, I don't know, almost probably octogenarian living up in Vermont, but big career in the electric industry. And she's been really the champion of this fragile grid for some time. So the second question you ask, what does it mean to us? And I'll just say what it means to me. I'm a person who's lived in a relatively stable electric grid. I really haven't thought much about having an offsite generator because I could afford to just not have power the one or two times I had it. But I think what it means even for me is if I want to live my life fairly normally, it's probably time for me to think about putting in a propane generator in my home.
Hey, Tucker, I'll confess and say that I haven't looked at the study. And so for my benefit, and maybe for some of those out there, what's the driver for the blackouts? Is it just onslaught of demand, whether it's power generation or LNG exports or, you know, what is that trigger that's going
to
cause it?
Stuart, it's interesting about what people will try to blame it on, and maybe we'll come back to that because to me, I don't really follow politics or drama much, but it really is amazing to me what I would call the disinformation spread around this. I think the cause is probably threefold, and maybe everything's got three causes. But the one is, I think utilities in general have just poorly invested in their own future. Now, we can talk about whether it's because the rules of the grid or the complexity of who generates power, who transports power, who receives power. But I think utilities have severely underinvested. I do think, in studying this quite a bit, it's a little shocking. The grid has been relatively flat in demand over a long, long period. And even when there was growth, the growth was 0.5%, 1%. I mean, we rarely have seen the grid grow more than 2%. And now we're talking about maybe 30% growth in most areas' grid demand over the next 5 to 7 years, almost all directly related to data center work, right? They're just a true explosion of data center. So this lack of general investment, now this newfound, really, I mean, let's just be real and call it like tenfold increase in demand that no one was set up to handle. And then I do think the last of it is just the regulations are onerous. So even if you have a good idea, even if it's investable, it's really hard to get permits and build plants and connect them to the customer centers. It's just really difficult. And to be honest, if we could ever get utilities to invest wisely, that would be helpful. We see the demand in front of us. I don't know how we ever fix that third problem in that, you know, we're a bunch of private fiefdoms, right? There's FERC and there's DOE and there's all kinds of land issues. And then there are just so many rules about making and transporting power. And I don't see those rules getting a lot easier over the next 2 decades, really, for that matter. So which leads me to a lot of excitement I have for both natural gas and propane. I do think a big part of this is going to be some decentralized grids, right? People need power. People are going to demand power, and they're not going to necessarily be able to build, you know, 30 gigawatt, 500 gigawatt nuclear plants. They're going to start looking for a lot more easily scalable plants. And I think that probably bids well for both natural gas and propane.
Now, so Tucker, I work in the midstream industry, and, you know, methane's kind of our game. And one of the weird things we see, especially out in the Permian where we're doing most of the gas processing, is running out of electricity. So there's a massive, I think it's $3 or $6 billion project to bring in transmission line to buff the grid up from East Texas all the way across to West Texas, because there's just such a demand in power. And one of the hard things is to make the natural gas to shift to the power companies, we have to have power for ourselves to be able to do that, right? So it's kind of a chicken and egg thing. And so getting that reliability has been difficult, and I foresee more of that in the future. And then we just had a podcast about talking about Boston case study where they're not able to get natural gas into their, you know, city really because of permitting issues and all kinds of things. And so question to you, in the future, given that reliability is going down, there's anticipated to be more blackouts, do you see kind of a big market opening up for consumer products or things to get propane or natural gas or something in, like you mentioned, a generator, personal generators, things like that to kind of help people out?
You know, I've always been the fuel of choice, I think, for personal generators, right? I mean, I think if you have natural gas to your home, highly likely you put in a natural gas generator. But, you know, even Texas showed us a few things about every once in a while when the world really comes to an end, sometimes even that gas gets pretty heavily curtailed or has pressure problems. We saw that in the Northeast with Superstorm Sandy. We've seen it two or three times. But there are, I was looking at the data last week and it surprised me. Let's call it 6 million homes have primary heat using propane, and probably about 5 million homes use a propane generator today. I don't even know how many use natural gas generators, but yeah, I think that's going to always be the source of a generator, because a generator on propane or natural gas is just a wonderful thing, right? It runs when you need it almost always. You know, you're not worried about diesel fuel weathering, or you're just not worrying about it. And for a propane generator, you're not worried about how much storage. If you want your generator to run for 2 weeks, you make sure you store enough propane on site to run for 2 weeks. It's that simple. What I'm seeing, though, is now the scale's moving up. So industrial parks, for example, that at one point didn't even think about using propane fuel generators. They were automatic. They could either use diesel or likely just have a deal with a local utility. Now I see them really entertaining using propane generators. One, we've got the sizes now. 10 years ago, you wanted to talk to us about a 2-megawatt power gen site, we would have sold you some converted natural gas engines, but they really weren't very good. Fast forward to today, we got really good engines. And so that's where I see, in fact, we're even playing with data centers now in ways that I personally, 5 years ago, I would have said, that's going to be the home of LNG beyond the main, you know, natural gas somewhere near the main. But now we're seeing some of these places that are choosing sites where just natural gas isn't available. And you, just back to your original point, I was a natural gas guy for a long time. I've been a propane guy for all the other time. And I'll travel places like suburbs of Philadelphia that are just natural gas rich, but there'll be these pockets of propane subdivisions because for one reason or another, it was very difficult to run a natural gas main into that area at the time. Maybe there was a 12-lane highway that was prohibitive to bore. Maybe it was at a time when nat gas was curtailed. But it's shocking to me how much propane is sold into the heart of natural gas country even today. But with as I say to the industry, it is inevitable that propane is going to fill part of that power demand niche. It's not whether we want it or not. It's coming to use propane because at the end of the day, there aren't a lot of other suitable alternatives that are affordable and clean.
Well, so we touched on a lot there. I mean, sort of the intersection between midstream and commercial use, right? Brian's a little bit constrained there in West Texas, and we pointed out a couple other places. I mean, what are your thoughts on that as far as how we kind of get out of it? I mean, what's your opinion on how we kind of move forward?
Well, it's interesting that we're kind of coming out of a political environment where natural gas and natural gas liquids were maligned, you know, for 4 or 5 years. And now we're in a spot where natural gas and natural gas liquids are probably revered as the solution. I would say 7 years ago, when you studied where's nuclear going, where's coal going, where's regulations going, it was always about natural gas. In fact, it was always about natural gas liquids, and to a degree when nuclear power would wake up and catch up. I see, you know, people use different words. We're in the emergence of the natural gas age. This is going to be the natural gas. This is the dawn of the natural gas era. However you want to say it, I think it still will be intensely natural gas where there are mains and propane beyond the mains. Mm-hmm. And the one place it is an interesting playground is we do pretty well using propane power generation. I mean, I just saw a facility in Chile that was 54 megawatts. And of course, we're the power backbone for the Virgin Islands. Today, we make all the power in Roatan Bay. So we've got lots of, you know, 20, 30 megawatt systems, but we play really nicely up to 5 or 6 megawatts. And then in today's world, I think it becomes a CNG or an LNG world. Like particularly, Brian, you talk about the Permian. I had to go see the Permian. I had to understand it for myself. And seeing where power generation was going, how CNG, LNG playing in that space, how's propane playing in that space. And it's interesting because I think you're going to see a lot more penetration of propane into that marketplace just because at the price you're paying for electricity, you can arbitrage propane to make power. It's a pretty good arbitrage on both sides, right? The propane people can sell it for more than they're used to selling it for, and you still convert it to power at a price less than you're used to paying for the power. So we're going to continue to see that evolution for sure. I think this is the beginning of a decade. I mean, let's look at a decade right now. Nuclear power is kind of back in, you know, vogue. But if you were not worried about financing, you really were pretty well permitted, you're still probably 12 to 15 years before you make power. And people talk a lot about SMRs, you know, small modular reactors. They're going to be the solutions. And, you know, we're seeing them start to deploy in some odd places like a former coal mine or, you know, places that have infrastructure. But still, even those, if you could build one in a decade, that's fast right now. And I don't think anybody who really loves an SMR is really talking up right now the levelized cost of power from it. We haven't figured out how to shrink them and shrink our cost too. So they're a little bit pricier compared to a traditional nuclear power plant. I just think the next decade plus, short of some odd regulation out of a new president or a new EPA or DOE, this is the age of natural gas and therefore natural gas liquids.
Hey, Tucker, I know you guys are the Propane Education and Research Council. And so just curious, what are you telling consumers? Are you talking about affordability, reliability, climate? Just talk a little bit about how you guys are engaging the propane consumers out there or the potential propane consumers out there.
Yeah, that's a really interesting question because I think partly I know what we want to tell them about natural gas and propane and to a degree, maybe some things we wish they'd know about diesel fuel or electricity. And then we spend a lot of time sampling and talking to not only consumers, but business owners about what language are they using, right? What's really important to them? Because I think, you know, again, the last 4 or 5 years is the government, and let's kind of lead it with DOE, you know, has really been leading this conversation around people want sustainable solutions. I laugh. I gave a talk to the DOE, I don't know, 3 years ago now. And at the end of my talk, one person came up and said, gosh, you talk more about affordability than we really do at DOE. Well, that's apparent because affordability is probably the top priority, I would say, around the world, right? And that's something that DOE just refused to accept, that if hydrogen costs five times what green hydrogen costs, five times what gray hydrogen costs, I'm sure people will want green hydrogen. So long-winded way to your answer, we're talking to people now. And it's funny, I think we loved part of Biden in that Biden was, you know, trying to at least talk about clean fuels. And I think they completely had it wrong. Fossil fuels aren't binary, right? They're not all bad and they're not all good. Clearly coal, oil, and wood are a lot dirtier than natural gas and propane. I would argue electricity made from coal, oil, wood, maybe throw a little biomass in there, is equally bad, right? And so the first thing we've really tried to talk to consumers is that fossil fuels aren't binary. Natural gas and propane are much better for the environment than you've been led to believe. The second part of it, we know that affordability is important. And so we really talked about affordable solutions. The last thing we've talked about to some success is to really explain to consumers, and these can be consumers acting as individuals, or they could be business owners as well. And it's a broad audience we talk to, is, you know, the inherent risk sometimes in using diesel fuel when you had natural gas or propane options in transportation, in stationary power generation, in towable generation, and that if you had a choice, you should choose propane or natural gas. Inherently less expensive, inherently cleaner, much easier to transport and store, if we're talking about propane versus diesel fuel, and as domestic a fuel as you'll ever envision. So, I mean, it's funny, Stuart, we find we don't get a lot of traction talking to them about NOx and SOx and particulate matter. We use the word clean, and then sometimes we'll go one level deeper. But normally we just talk about clean, domestic, affordable, and that's where we stop.
So it's been about a year since your book, Path to Zero, came out. First off, I guess, what's kind of the story and the reasoning behind that and got you going down that path? But, you know, we talked about data centers and relatively new energy growth. I mean, what's been your feedback since that book came out, and kind of how does that correlate with what you wrote, but also what's changed, or what would you like to change, you know, that might be different?
You know, it's funny. That is a great question, and one that I'm probably most proud of about the book, in that, you know, you say the book came out, we were at Climate Week, I guess, really a year ago, we really released it, but we had been about 18 months working on it, maybe even as much as 2 years. So what I'm probably proudest of is that, with the exception of maybe a little bit of data center demand, which has now become a little bit more front and center, everything we thought would happen and wrote about is happening. And that's really interesting. And to your original question, what caused us to do that? At the time we wrote that, Biden was clearly in the middle of his presidency. There was this movement towards renewable electricity being the solution. Green hydrogen would take care of everything that renewable electricity couldn't handle. And we just knew that wasn't true, right? We could see into Europe and see where they were, because I always argue in a lot of cases they've been 4 or 5 years ahead of us in this transition. And I could see what was and wasn't working. And we just wanted to kind of take some of the stories out of the podcast and bring them more to life. And, you know, if you put the three pieces of the book into play, I think one, because at the time we were fairly divisive, right? It was about, you know, the pro-environmental camp and the anti-environmental camp. I don't ever know who was in the anti-environmental camp, because I'm sure the oil and gas industry was not, right? Anytime they said, well, something you're saying about this environmental story doesn't quite make sense, right? It's not going to be good for the environment. It's not going to be good for consumers. It's certainly not going to be good for our own energy security. But the minute you had a dissenting view, you were already painted as a fossil fuel advocate and just smeared with mud. But we wanted to say, one, we needed to have an open and honest debate, right? It took people talking to get to a more rational solution. The other part of that was that technology would give us the solutions. And I would argue, I mean, I think I've kind of watched a lot of that Inflation Reduction Act and was probably livid at the time about the forced, just some of the sizes of the grants were really drawing true innovation. They were drawing people who knew really well how to get money. And then they really weren't moving forward in what I would call scalable solutions. They were much more effective at getting government grants. But with certainty, innovation, engineering innovation, maybe changes in how we live our lives, innovation could prevail and get us to a better spot. And I think the third piece that we try to pepper through there is there was no reason to be pessimistic, right? There was no reason to stop living our lives. There was total reason for optimism if, in fact, we let innovators innovate, and we made sure that people discussed the pros and cons of all things. And I do think that that's just going to continue to have to happen. I mean, in many cases, Trump and his rhetoric is a little bit unnerving to me, because I would like people to say, gosh, we should be more mindful of the environment, right? There are things we can do. you know, as simple as make sure your furnace is working well and you don't leave your windows open at night or you have decent windows, whatever. It's ridiculous to waste resources, whether it's energy, water, land, or air, right? And so he's probably a little harsher on that rhetoric than we've been. But what I find is that still resonates with consumers, that consumers want to do well for their community, for their environment, as long as it doesn't cost them too much or it's too difficult to achieve. The book was a way just to kind of open the conversation that we didn't think was very well being had at the moment. And it's still interesting. I mean, I still see Trump get painted in this corner as being oblivious to the environment, which isn't true at all. I mean, he's clearly financially driven, but until we have a strong economy, we couldn't do things to improve our lot. I mean, I'll lead you into that, but look at where Germany is today. Look at where France is going. Look at Eastern Europe versus Western Europe. I mean, it's just a tale of two economies. And I'm glad that we have kind of recorrected course a bit.
Just from conversations I've had, most people is generally people want both, right? They want reliability, they want affordability, but they also want clean energy, right? It's not mutually exclusive, right? They like both. So speaking on that, and then just the fact that it looks like data centers, energy demand keeps going up. I don't think that's going away anytime soon. What are some kind of technologies and stuff that you've seen out there that, you know, next year, 2026, outlook on energy and diversification and how the renewables and fossil fuels go with each other? What do you think that looks like in America?
Yeah, it's funny. I've kind of been on the phone this morning with my contemporaries in Europe talking about renewable fuels a bit, because I think all of us are a little bit lost. You know, renewable natural gas has done a good job of using landfill waste and, you know, a bunch of dairy, you know, digesters to make probably about 1B a day, I think, in renewable natural gas. That's, you know, they've done a really good job. The liquid side of that house hasn't done as well, right? We make today, maybe on a good year, we're making 30 million gallons, which is, you know, we use in the U.S. 10 billion gallons domestically. That's just consumers using 10 billion gallons. So 30 million gallons of renewable propane is not much. So we're really at a kind of a point in time where we're trying to reevaluate what is the cost of electricity? How do we get to a more renewable future? And I think that's really relevant to someone even thinking about putting a furnace in tomorrow, right? Should I use a heat pump? Because everybody tells me solar and wind will be the dominant form of electricity by 2050. Or should I use a really good gas furnace that I know will keep me warm and trust my natural gas or propane company that it'll be fueled with renewable fuels, probably well before 2050. Technology that we're working on is in the middle space. There's already some really cool stuff for power generation around megawatt solutions. I mean, just two that come to mind, Mainspring and Hylion. They're just two real state-of-the-art linear accelerators. They're not really even generators. They just move differently, behave differently, ridiculously low emissions. But again, this is a world where using them to generate power is a tad more expensive than using a traditional generator. We're seeing an influx of equipment from Europe. Names that are commonplace in Europe, Jenbacher, which is kind of a really well-known stuff you'd be seeing in the Permian today. But Jenbacher, Rolls-Royce, a Spanish company called Glascor, they're bringing state-of-the-art propane engines into the Americas now. And we're not going to be utility-scale power generation from that, but for everybody from a fast food restaurant to a hospital to a nursing home to a car wash to a industrial park to even a edge data center, we'll be generating their power. And I think the technology that's most exciting to me, we're in the middle of it right now, is a bunch of fuel cells. So it's funny, I just visited a house early this morning to see some of the latest technology, but there you kind of making decisions almost on the minute. Do I want to produce power for my home? Do I want to take power from the utility and sell power back to the utility. And that's kind of where we see this three-way power exchange going on, residentially, commercial, or industrial scale. You know, you see it now. There are a couple of companies out. Enchanted Rock is one that leads the story here, where they'll go to, I mean, they're claiming to fame. I guess they went to HEB Groceries and said, let me be your power backbone. And then in exchange, they're doing the calculus every minute. Should HEB buy power from the utility? Should we make them power? Or should we, in fact, make them power and sell more power back to utility? We're seeing that scale down now to the consumer. And I think that's where we'll spend in the next 5 years. Power around the country varies dramatically, right? One thing's universal, and I bet most people listening to this power, this podcast haven't paid attention, but your own power bills, you would be unusual if your own local power bill has increased less than 15% year over year.
Mm-hmm.
I saw a chart the other day, but power in California, everybody knows is expensive. It can be 48 or 50 cents. What people don't realize is that number is also in quite a few other states around this country right now, particularly at peak demand. So we're seeing a bunch of this technology. It's like, here, let me run the calculus and decide whether on an hourly basis I'm going to buy power, use power, or sell power. And it's pretty exciting what I think the next 5 to 10 years will bring in that whole area. Because all of a sudden, everybody's house, everybody's industry, maybe even everybody's homeowners association will be a little mini power plant. And I do think that's how we're going to get through this demand from data centers. I keep waiting to see somebody invent the next generation chip, which is more energy efficient. But I'm trying to be as deep into that as you can, and that's not in the talk right now at all.
Tucker, you sound optimistic that it's going to be easy to either buy power, sell power, put power on the grid. I don't know. Conversations I hear here in Washington, D.C., it seems like some regulators have some stuff to say about that. I mean, what's the take on the appetite for, you know, regulators to allow consumers to put stuff back on the grid?
Yeah, I think, well, and because the real issue is at net metering, right? Generally, it's not can you put it back on the grid? It's generally at what price are you contractually bound to pay? And actually, I told you this house I looked at this morning, that's a net metering arrangement where they buy and sell at the same price. And we all know that makes no sense, right? That's not a long-term solution. The utility would provide you power and all of the add-ons that a utility would have. And then in return, they'll buy power back at the same rate. Makes no sense. So we know that's gone away. And I do think we all know that FERC is powerful. What I don't think I really realized until you study it is the ISOs, the electric authorities, they probably make FERC look almost weak and inferior in terms, you know, I live in the PJM grid, right? And it's amazing how backward our investments have been. We haven't been looking forward at all. How deep a hole we're in, how deep a hole the executives of the PJM know we are in, because they see the forward curves on the prices, right? And they're almost, it's just too big to turn that ship with any speed. But to your point, a lot of this gets really daunting when you bring into fiefdoms and, you know, or just hierarchical power. And that's one reason you hear me talk more and more about decentralized solutions. I think that's the inevitable stopgap while these fiefdoms get recreated. The one thing that is constant, and it shocks me sometimes, but it's just as constant, is even people's inability to change, right? We are all such creatures of habit. I'm kind of surprised we don't all drive Model Ts still to a degree, right? It's just, that's what my dad drove. That's what his dad drove. Must be good enough for me. And that's kind of how we live our lives, right? I'm going to live in a house with four walls and these kind of windows, and I'm going to do it the way I've always done it. So now when we're talking about a completely different way of delivering And as I say, live in our love affair with electricity, it's going to take some shifting. And people aren't ready for it yet. I don't see any of y'all on this call thinking about using OpenAI or ChatGPT less, right? And I've had a talk with a couple governors that are just deep into data centers and say, what's the deal? And they'll tell you point blank. They pay great taxes. They don't put kids in the schools. They don't put cars on the highway. They are a great thing for my state and its tax base. And I not only have a lot, I want a lot more. And so that's why I tend to really think a lot more about decentralized power. Everything from a 3-bedroom, 1-bath brick ranch home to a data center and everything in between.
Super interesting. Well, that leads us to what we usually ask to wrap up the show here as we're coming up on time, but interesting discussion about the future. So let's do this. It's 3 years from now. What has gone on that's caused you to be happy and optimistic? And we definitely want to have you on in 3 years. So maybe we can make some predictions here.
Anyway, to me, that you might think that's a really challenging question, but to me, it's an easy answer, is I would love to think that in 3 years that people begin to have a more balanced view of the value of American natural gas and propane in their town and their economy and their environment and to their own kids' health and prosperity. Because I think, you know, even in the nat gas world, all we hear about is, well, this well in Pennsylvania messed up somebody's, you know, water well, or methane is such a horrible greenhouse gas. And as an industry, we've been terrible. I'm a little bit critical sometimes of AGA even for really not telling the story too well of how natural gas has done a great role in reducing their own carbon footprint. Leaks are much less pronounced than they were in the 50s. And then again, in the 60s, I mean, we've done such a great job. And I think consumers listen sometimes to, you know, the anti-advocates that think every power plant can just be fueled by honeybees and walnuts. And so 3 years from now, I'm hoping that consumers will have a really great understanding of how valuable natural gas, the natural gas infrastructure, has been for not only their own prosperity, but for the health and safety of their children and their grandchildren.
Well, Tucker, thank you so much for your time. We'll definitely have you on before the 3-year time mark there. We hope to have you on, maybe see where we're at in that path. But definitely everyone go check out the book, Path to Zero. You can find that anywhere where books are sold. And we really appreciate your time today and look forward to hearing more here soon.
Well, I enjoy listening to your podcast and thanks for getting the message out. It's good. Thanks for having me today.
Thank you for listening to the Let's Clear the Air Energy Podcast. If you like what you have heard, subscribe and rate us on your favorite podcast app. You can email us with questions or comments to Let's Clear the Air Energy Podcast @gmail.com.